The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome. My name is Bill Snape. I'm a practitioner in residence and a fellow here at the Washington College of Law. For full disclosure, because it will be very relevant for this panel, my practicing role is with the Center for Biological Diversity, which has some views on the topic we're going to discuss. I will endeavor to maintain my objectivity, but you never know. I thought I would at least put that on the table. For those who know me, know that's, it's hard for me to do that sometimes. We have three excellent panelists, three legal practitioners and scholars themselves for whom I have great respect. Kyle Danish is a partner in the law firm of Van Ness and Feldman and is the coordinator of the firm's climate change and emissions trading practice. His clients include electric, power, oil, gas, and mineral resource companies. He is involved in many aspects of environmental regulation, particularly global warming. And at this point, I should take a step back. I realize I haven't really actually introduced the topic. This is now the last topic this afternoon on regulation under the new Obama administration. We're going to cover the field of the environment, broadly defined. What we decided to do with this panel is to have the focus predominantly be on global warming. The panelists will not be chained to that topic. They are certainly invited to talk about other environmental regulation that isn't related to global warming. But I think all three would agree, and certainly it is my opinion, that global warming, the reality of climate change, is impacting other environmental programs themselves and is certainly a force by itself. By way of introduction, Kyle Danish has been very much in the center of representing industry groups in the debate before Congress, before the agencies, particularly EPA. And while I don't always agree with Kyle, my friend Kyle, who I've known for many years and our sons played on a baseball team together, has always, in my view, been a voice of reasonableness and moderation, and I always listen very carefully to what he has to say. Similarly, David Doniger, policy director and senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Before his stint at NRDC, he was with the Clinton administration. Before that, he was with NRDC. David is one of the preeminent experts on the Clean Air Act in the country. He has been, in the environmental side, very much in the center of what's been happening on Capitol Hill with attempts to pass a climate bill, and I very much look forward to his remarks and his thoughts. He was also intimately involved in climate change issues in the Clinton administration, so he has not only NGO and environmental advocacy experience, he's been with the executive branch and has seen it from that lens as well. Professor Rena Steinzohr is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and teaches an environmental survey course as well as offerings in risk assessment, critical issues in law and science, legal methods, contracts, and an introduction to the administrative system. Professor Steinzohr has a long list of publications. Her most recent book is Mother Earth and Uncle Sam, How Pollution and Hollow Government Hurt Our Kids, published by the University of Texas Press in 2007. She is founder and president of the Center for Progressive Reform, a think tank comprised of 57 member scholars from universities around the United States. Not only does Professor Steinzohr have a tremendous academic and intellectual background on this issue, she worked on Capitol Hill. She worked for then Representative James Florio in the House when the House Energy and Commerce Committee was considering and indeed passed amendments to Superfund and the Asbestos Hazardous Emergency Response Act. So not only does Professor Steinzohr have academic experience in risk analysis and risk benefit and global warming, she has seen the world from Capitol Hill and will be able to provide her perspective on what's happening with global warming and, again, other environmental issues from that perspective. Let me say this about global warming and environmental regulation under the Obama administration in general. There has always been a tension in environmental regulation, probably in other fields as well, for which I am not expert, between wanting the environmental regime to be effective, to achieve its environmental goal, versus the idea of making sure that in achieving that environmental goal, it is efficient, that it's done so in an efficient manner. And this effectiveness-efficiency dichotomy has existed since the 70s when the modern statutory environmental regime was created by Congress, and it exists to this very day. When you talk about the idea of cost-benefit analysis, which has also been around at least since President Reagan and before, but President Reagan sort of put it on the front burner in terms of his criticism of the modern regulatory state, you get into the adage that sometimes we know the cost of everything but the value of nothing. And so when we talk about cost-benefit analysis, when we talk about OMB and this administration's efforts to deal with all regulations, particularly environmental regulations, keep that in mind. And one of the things I've noticed in my 20 years of practice is, and I wonder to myself, is this an inevitable evolution to translating all values, particularly environmental values, into numbers? Is that where this is all really headed? Because if that is where we're headed, that puts notions like ecological values in a very different type of category. And it's a tension that I'm not sure is ever ultimately resolvable, but it is a tension I hope the three panelists today can at least touch upon. Again, you are not bound by global warming, but I think all three are able to talk about global warming. The way this is going to work is that each panelist will get about 5 to 7 minutes to make an opening set of remarks. Then we have a set of three questions that the panelists saw in advance that will sort of hopefully have some discussion, and then I'll make sure that by the end, which Mel, the end will be, where is Mel? That will be roughly when? 4:05, 4:10? Okay. We will make sure we also have an opportunity from questions from the audience as well. So first, I think we will go in order in which they are seated. Kyle Danish. Thank you, Kyle.
Well, thank you, Professor Snape, and thank you, all of you who've come today for this program. It covers a whole bunch of different areas. We're going to move on to the environmental regulation now, and I think it's an interesting time for the Obama Environmental Protection Agency. They had already quite an agenda kind of left over from the Bush administration EPA, owing in part to the inactivity of some of the Bush administration in the environmental area. And also, I think, owing to the fact that where they were active, they tended to come up with rules that were turned away at the courts. So this left quite a load for the Environmental Protection Agency. And also, in some ways, the court decisions, I guess in the old adage, kind of bad cases make bad law. I don't know that it's truly bad law, but some of the decisions that were sparked by Bush administration Environmental Protection Agency rules have had the effect of saying to the agency, no, you've gone too far, you need to really stay within the four corners of this statute in ways I think that may narrow the flexibility of this EPA where it might really want some. I will focus on climate change, and I think in this particular area, the Obama EPA has a very difficult job, in part because it's a reluctant regulator. Not that it's reluctant to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, but it's somewhat reluctant to regulate under the statute that it has for this purpose, which is the Clean Air Act. The Obama administration generally has had a preference in the area of climate change for a new legislative framework from Congress that would be structured in some ways that adopt from, but in many ways diverge from, the Clean Air Act. And the first choice has been an economy-wide cap-and-trade program along the lines of bills that were considered in the House and the Senate last year. But we haven't gotten to that. And why is that a problem? Well, first, I think it's helpful to talk a little bit about climate change as an environmental problem and some of its unique characteristics. One is that it's global. It's truly global. The United States is a tremendous part of global emissions, but still three-quarters of the emissions come from elsewhere, and ultimately we need a large cooperative effort. Secondly, there are numerous sources of greenhouse gas emissions, some of which are quite small. Many are very diverse sources. It's not only power plants and cars, but also homes that use natural gas, farms, forests. The costs of mitigating emissions at these different types of sources vary considerably. the techniques for mitigating emissions also vary a lot, and in many ways haven't really been invented yet. This is an area where we're really looking for policies that can encourage innovation and technological transformation. Something that's kind of a unique aspect of climate change as an environmental problem that also, in a sense, creates opportunities for policy is that the atmosphere is generally indifferent to the location of emissions. Emissions from Boston have the same effect on the atmosphere as do emissions from Brazil. So we have, in a sense, some flexibility about where emission reductions and mitigation and sequestration can come from. And importantly here, because the costs vary so much, policies that allow for some flexibility can be very effective and cost-effective. There's also a certain amount of temporal flexibility. Climate change is known not as a flow problem, where what you put into the atmosphere today comes down on you tomorrow, but more of a stock problem. Emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, and it's this accumulation that we're concerned about. It implies we have to get going now to do something about it, but there's also some flexibility within periods. An emission reduction 5 years from now may have about the same effect as one today or even 10 years from now. So we have some amount of flexibility about exactly when we kind of come down hardest. So why, given this unique set of characteristics, why the preference for an economy-wide cap-and-trade program? One, there's a certainty about the emissions you achieve from a cap program, a certainty that you don't necessarily get from putting out a kind of phalanx of different standards of various kinds, various sources. Importantly, with this cap, you can phase it down over time and just phase down the cap. You don't have to play with a million different dials of standards, but you just have a declining cap. Secondly, thirdly, you can deal with small sources in an interesting way in an economy-wide program. You're not stuck just regulating sources of emissions. You can go upstream of those sources. You can regulate fossil fuel as it comes into the economy and thereby effectively cover the smaller users of fossil fuels. And importantly, there is this flexibility. We're not commanding, controlling particular sources. We have a cap. We have a certain amount of allowances, a certain amount of rights to emit. And we can create, therefore, a system in which sources that can do a lot at low cost will do a lot at low cost, and sources for whom costs are quite high will not. In a sense, we can get to a particular emissions goal with, at least in theory, the lowest cost set of reduction activities. Something that I think people overlook as an advantage of an economy-wide program, also cap-and-trade program, is through the allocation of allowances, the auctioning of allowances, we can generate revenues. And if you look at the way people have talked about the Waxman-Markey bill or the Kerry-Boxer bill, these revenues are very important for several reasons. One, they can create a fund for technology. They can be used to ameliorate the consequences of the program on certain people. They can also be used to support international efforts. They can be a way that we link with other countries and encourage greater activity from other countries. The problem with the Clean Air Act is that it doesn't have a lot of these characteristics. It's fairly oriented towards local and regional air pollution. The approach is basically a command and control approach of choosing certain source categories of sources and selecting particular technologies or emission limits for those, which then have to be revised over time. You're stuck, in a sense, regulating potentially very, very small sources, even though it would be more efficient to go upstream of those sources. It does not develop in its own design revenues that can be used for other purposes. The linkage with other countries is difficult to achieve through a Clean Air Act-based program. And to achieve essentially the declining cap, you have to create standards for multiple different types of sources and continuously revise them over time. It's difficult to promote technological innovation in this kind of approach. There's no incentive to go farther than any particular standard. And the standards themselves have to be relatively kind of lowest common denominator for for a particular category. Nevertheless, EPA is being forced to do what it can with the Clean Air Act, and that's for several reasons. One, there's a Supreme Court case out there, the Massachusetts v. EPA case, that creates more or less a mandate for EPA to regulate in this area. EPA has had to resolve a very complex dispute among states and automakers to come up with a federal set of vehicle standards, which I think was a smart solution for that, but drives EPA into essentially mandated regulation under the Clean Air Act. And finally, and most importantly, Congress has simply stalled. I mean, I think it, you know, arguably it was one thing if you had an imminent legislative program, but it's hard to say there is one right now. And EPA can only essentially hold off for so long. So EPA is looking down a regulatory march here under the Clean Air Act. And here's what's quite interesting for an administrative law symposium. They're doing quite a lot, essentially, to hold this tiger of the Clean Air Act by its tail, because they want to make it as effective as possible. And I think truly the issue here is not just cost effectiveness, but literally effectiveness, whether it can be as effective environmentally as an economy-wide cap and trade. But they're going to try to make it as effective as possible. They're going to try to make it as efficient as possible. They're going to have to try to figure out ways it does not lead to its kind of worst pathways in terms of onerous burdens, because they could always get a reaction from Congress that is a little bit in the offing right now that would take away their Clean Air Act authority. So I think what we're going to be seeing, we're already seeing over this year with the Obama administration EPA, is essentially the utilization of a whole quiver of administrative law techniques and practices and strategies to make the Clean Air Act as rational as it can be in this area and as effective as it can be in this area. And I'll give if I can real quickly give the first example of that, an example of both what the Clean Air Act and its kind of ordinary usage would drive you to and how EPA is trying to manage it, is something called the tailoring rule. And if you'll bear with me, it goes like this. Once EPA regulates motor vehicles, creates the motor vehicle standards it's on track to regulate, it will make greenhouse gas emissions subject to regulation, a pollutant subject to regulation. This triggers, like Clean Air Act is kind of like this piece of machinery. This mobile source regulation over here triggers something for stationary sources over there. Because as soon as you make a pollutant subject to regulation, new or modified major emitting facilities of that pollutant are subject to something called the Prevention Significant Deterioration Program. It's a very stringent program. Requires you to install best available control technology and otherwise get a whole set of permitting requirements. But this backed best available control technology requirement is very strict. Now, under the plain language of the Clean Air Act, a major emitting facility is a facility that emits 250 tons of a pollutant. Now, for conventional pollutants that you normally see regulated under the Clean Air Act, that's a lot. That'd probably be a power plant, you know, with ozone, NOx, nitrogen oxide. Now, for carbon dioxide, 250 tons, a bakery has something like 250 tons. So we're looking at something where you'd be regulating potentially millions of very small sources with this very stringent technology requirement. What EPA has said is, okay, we're going to do something here called the tailoring rule, and we're going to try to phase this in. We're going to say in this area, we're going to start with the larger sources, 25,000 tons, for a period of time, and then explore lowering the threshold. And they've cited a couple legal rationales for this interpretation of their authority. One is that this is necessary to avoid absurd results, and also that it's out of administrative necessity. It would be impossible to administer a program that required permits and technology from so many millions of small facilities. This will be an interesting test of the administrative law of the Clean Air Act for them to carry this out. And there are many more tests to follow in their interpretation of new source performance standards, in their interpretation of whether they need to follow through with national ambient air quality standards, in the extent to which they can introduce market-based approaches in these areas. They're already thinking about that for the best available control technology requirement. Can we introduce some amount of flexibility into that area. So I would say this is going to be a fascinating run for administrative law to see how the EPA does this and tries to walk this line between achieving what it can from the Clean Air Act and I think hoping in some ways that Congress will come in with a rational, comprehensive program that will be not only cost-effective, but I think literally environmentally effective compared to the Clean Air Act. Thank you.
Thanks. It's nice to be here today. And Kyle has covered some of the same ground that I'll cover, so I'll be able to sort of work off of his scaffolding, if I may. Give maybe a little bit more of a historical perspective. The modern Clean Air Act was enacted 40 years ago, this year, 1970 Clean Air Act. And it was shorter then, but its basic outlines were set then. And it's a very durable framework. The fundamental part of the Clean Air Act, the sort of cross-cutting starting point, is a requirement that the agency, the EPA, should be keeping up with science and following developments in the science on the dangers of pollutants, public health dangers, dangers to welfare. Welfare is a broadly defined concept, long list of attributes of the environment other than human health, including very specifically a damage to climate. They were thinking ahead in 1970 and wrote damage to climate and damage to the weather into the Clean Air Act as reasons to regulate. So there was an initial set of pollutants that everyone knew about at the time, the ones that cause urban smog and sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, the hydrocarbons that lead to ozone smog, a few other pollutants. Very few of these broadly dispersed pollutants added since, lead, the element lead being one of them. There was another set of amendments later on that added a long list of hazardous or toxic air pollutants. But all along, the authority was there to respond to science and add new pollutants to the list of regulated ones. Actually, a pollutant is defined as any chemical, any physical substance thrown into the air from vehicles or industrial activities. So along the end of the 90s, EPA received a petition from a small group of environmental groups, not generally the major groups, saying, look, CO2 is dangerous. It has an adverse effect on our health and our welfare through the greenhouse effect, and the other greenhouse gases do too. You need, EPA, to regulate their emissions from motor vehicles. That was the scope of the petition that was put before EPA. The Clinton administration did not act on it. This came in near the very end. We thought we had more time than we turned out to have. And the Congress was in Republican hands at the time, and there were a number of areas where Congress had intervened to override otherwise applicable obligations of law with funding riders. For example, they had blocked fuel economy standards from being issued under the transportation laws. So there was some reticence to act at that point. The Bush administration came in. That wasn't part of our plan. And in the course of the next 3 years, they finished a rulemaking to declare that despite the fact that CO2 is obviously a chemical thrown into the air by human industrial activities, it was not an air pollutant within the meaning of the Clean Air Act. And even if it were, they said, for a variety of reasons, they wouldn't regulate it. There's too much uncertainty, and there are other economic and political and foreign policy related rationales put forward as to why they wouldn't regulate it. So it was then in the what we've since started to call the dark days of the little ice age on global warming policy in Washington that we began the litigation together with coalition of states and environmental organizations, which culminated in Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court decision in 2007 that said, yes, Virginia, it is an air pollutant. It does meet all the definitional criteria. And if you determine that it's dangerous, you have to regulate it, and you need to go back. You're required to respond to the petition and make a determination. Does it endanger public health and welfare or not? And if it does, you have only one option, and that is to issue motor vehicle emission standards. So the Bush administration, for about a month, was on the program to comply with the law. There was this brief moment in May 2007 when the president went to the Rose Garden and announced that by the end of 2007 they would issue greenhouse gas emission standards. They thought better of that before the end of the year and canceled the project and temporized for the rest of the term. So Kyle, I think, or maybe it was Bill, mentioned that there was just a lot of activity or a lot of on the plate of the EPA when the Obama administration came in. But in a way, a lot of the homework was done. In the final 2 years of the Bush administration, whereas you might have seen in the first 5 or 6 years that the EPA was forbidden from thinking certain thoughts and researching certain things and doing anything. In the latter couple of years, the controls were coming off, the grip was being loosened, and in fact, part of the argument for why they were not acting under the Supreme Court decision was there's an awful lot of homework to do, and EPA has been charged to do all this homework. It was a complicated version of looking busy, but it did allow the EPA to get a lot of the groundwork done for a burst of regulatory activity during the last year. Part of it was to come out very quickly with the proposal that the greenhouse gases do, in fact, endanger public health and welfare. The administration took comment on this and got 300,000 or 400,000 public comments, mostly in favor, and in December published the final determination of endangerment. Actually, they don't have to do that as a separate rulemaking. They could have done that in the course of the vehicle standards rulemaking, which I'll tell you about in a second. But they chose to do it separately, and so be it. It's perfectly all right. That's now been challenged by probably about a dozen different industrial conservative think tank. It's just like every one of the legal foundations, Pacific, Southern, Washington, has brought their own case. I'm very curious to find out, you know, what the unifying campaign principle there is or who's behind these. But those cases will take shape over the next couple of months. The other key things that the Obama administration did in the course of the last year were to reach an agreement with the car industry, the United Auto Workers, the states of California, and 13 other states that had adopted state-level clean car standards, and the environmental community on what we've come to call the Clean Car Peace Treaty. And this was unveiled in the Rose Garden in May of last year with a ceremony in which President Obama was flanked by the dark-suited chief executives of 10 major automobile companies and the UAW. And Arnold Schwarzenegger and and Jennifer Granholm, the governors of California and Michigan, and environmental representatives were in the audience for this celebration of an agreement which provides for a national approach to greenhouse gas and fuel economy standards in a coordinated way and in a way that the states have agreed to follow. They have not been preempted, but they have agreed to fold their own, to accept the federal standards for the five-year period 2012 to 2016 as compliance with their own leadership standards. And basically what the auto industry, new standards deliver is the California level of emission reduction nationwide, but in a more flexible and uniform format that the auto industry was seeking. So it's a victory, really, all around. And the auto industry continues to back the agreement, as do we. Another big project that the EPA was able to finish was a set of rules and regulations for reporting of greenhouse gas, for measuring and reporting greenhouse gas emissions. This was done under the Clean Air Act, but specifically, Congress had specifically in 2007, I think it was, instructed EPA to do this rule in the appropriations legislation for that year. Now, what's coming, as Kyle described, is a set of requirements that apply to stationary sources, to industrial facilities. And Kyle did a good job of explaining the new source review program and the way EPA is tailoring it to continue to apply to the big sources and to not apply to hot dog stands and bakeries. I've written something which is on my blog site called It's Hard to Hide a Refinery Behind a Hot Dog Stand. And what you see is a spectacle where the big industrial facilities are complaining that the small ones are being let off the hook. And they are saying in a passive voice that EPA will be sued. And this is illegal to be changing the number from 250 tons to 25,000 or some other number, or to be messing with the date at which this program would commence. It will be very interesting to see who sues and who has standing to sue. The small sources don't seem to be upset to be excluded, and they shouldn't be. The environmental community is pretty uniformly committed to supporting EPA in tailoring this to focus the permit requirements on the big sources. And it's just not very clear whether there can be an effective challenge mounted to this rule. But it has led to, and Kyle mentioned this, I'll be very brief in finishing up on this, to a legislative proposal, a pushback from the Hill, mostly but not entirely from the Republican side, in the Senate led by Senator Murkowski, in the House by Representative Jerry Moran and Marsha Blackburn, two people who are whose extreme views on climate change are, well, extreme. And Senator Murkowski is not normally thought of as extreme, but she's quite hard over on this. They are trying to use the Congressional Review Act, which is a statute which allows for an expedited procedure for voting down or vetoing a new regulation. It has to pass both houses and be signed by the president. It's been done once, to my knowledge, at the beginning of the Bush administration. The Republican Congress, with the support of President Bush, vetoed ergonomic regulations that came out of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. But I'm not aware that any other regulations have been successfully invalidated in this way. And, of course, the Obama administration would never sign this legislation if it did pass the two houses. We're working hard to see that it doesn't pass in either house. One of the reasons it probably is not going to get anywhere is that the reversal of the endangerment determination would knock the legs out from under the Clean Car Peace Treaty, because you wouldn't be able to issue the nationally uniform vehicle standards that the auto industry helped negotiate and stands behind if you don't have the endangerment determination which is necessary to regulate under the Clean Air Act. And that would bring back to the fore the actions of the 14 states that are regulating under different parts of the Clean Air Act that don't depend on the endangerment determination. So it's a pickle the auto industry doesn't want to be in, nor does the United Auto Workers. And I think it's one of the reasons why the effort to invalidate the endangerment determination won't pass. Another reason, of course, is that it's seen by the majority as pure politics in terms of the reaction of the minority. I'm not going to comment on legislation, but maybe as a segue to Rena's presentation, I would draw attention to something which is coming as part of the vehicle regulations and maybe as a separate item, and that is some kind of an analytical position from the administration on what's called the social cost of carbon. Now, the private cost of carbon is reflected in the fact that if you own one of these new cars that controls greenhouse gas emissions and gets higher fuel economy, you will actually save money on your fuel bill because it just pays back over the life of the vehicle several times over in terms of lower fuel costs. And that's a private benefit that you capture. The public benefits or the social benefits are those which come to the society as a whole and aren't captured in the marketplace the way those fuel savings are. In other words, how much is it worth to avoid putting a ton of carbon in the atmosphere for regulatory purposes? And the cost-benefit process, which I'm sure Rena will be talking more about, asks that kind of question. And an exercise is underway within the administration to pull together the literature on economics literature and or synthesize the science and the economics literature to ask the question, what range of dollar values would you put on a ton of carbon emission reductions? Now, we are trying to make sure that some rather important benefits, if I can just, call them the kind of end-of-the-world type benefits, the real extreme consequences like changes in the weather patterns if you don't have ice over the Arctic Ocean anymore, or other, rather dramatic ecological and public health impacts, that these are not ignored. The trouble in many economic studies is things that have never happened before are hard to put a clear probability on, are hard to put hard to get a clear sense of all the ramifications. What would this mean for weather patterns? What would this mean for agriculture? What would this mean for snow removal in Washington? Things of this kind. And to put a dollar value on the tonnage, on each ton of reduction, is a very difficult enterprise. And we want to make sure that if the administration develops a social cost of carbon, that they have, in an appropriate way, thought through and hypothesized and tried to analyze what these high-end consequences would be and therefore the high-end benefits would be of each ton of carbon, each of the billion tons of carbon that could be removed. That kind of thing will show up over the next few years, I think, in administrative rulemakings and possibly in litigation. So that's a survey of, where we've been from the little ice age to where we are now. Thanks.
I'm going to give up on this idea that we only talk for a few minutes because it was very idealistic, but it never works unless you don't let anyone do introductory remarks. And I'm going to say my piece and then hopefully shut up in time so we can have some questions from the audience. I'm going to shift gears a little abruptly because I am myself personally not a climate change person, as shocking as this is. We were joking before the panel that the problem is that climate change is the ultimate fate of the world. But like every soccer team, if every team person runs after the same ball, runs after the ball, then we leave a lot of other things in the dust, like worker safety, consumer products, toxics, which are ultimately related to climate change, as I'll prove to you in the end, since climate change is so all-encompassing. First, a little word about my organization, which is the Center for Progressive Reform, or CPR, which was a definite acronym chosen to signify what we think needs to happen with the regulatory system. I'm very proud to declare my partnership with Professor Hunter, who's also a member scholar of CPR. He's being polite and sitting through this talk that he's heard before. I'm sure he came for you guys. We have put out a report called Obama's Regulators, a first-year report card. It's available on our site, which is www.progressivereform.org. And it considers the five what we call protector agencies. So that's EPA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Food and Drug Administration, and National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. When you think about it, that group of five has to do with what you breathe, what you drink, all the medicine you take, all the food you eat, and every product that you use, including your car. And so it is with a sense of great disappointment that I tell you that those agencies, by any measure, are in shambles at the moment. EPA is by far the strongest and most vigorous, and yet the Government Accountability Office has indicated some concern that EPA doesn't have enough resources to implement all the new climate change requirements that we thought were coming down the pike. Now, if we don't look to Congress, I think David is very wisely suggesting to us we should look at existing law, and it is vitally important in that context that we keep an eye on the EPA budget and how many resources they have to actually implement these ideas. We gave the Obama administration a B-minus, which was lower than most of the other report cards after their first year. And I want to explain a minute about the reasons for that. The good part of it was that we think the appointees for the agencies, these five agencies, who are Lisa Jackson, David Michaels at OSHA, Commissioner Tenenbaum at the CPSC, Commissioners Hamburg and Deputy Commissioner Sharfstein at FDA, and David Strickland at NHTSA are exceptionally qualified and talented people. These are all people who have a solid grounding professionally in the area that they are regulating. Several of them came from public service as opposed from any of the special interest groups that lobby their agencies, and they have all hit the ground running with an absolute commitment to revitalize these agencies, shake them up, and get them heading in the right direction. That's very heartening. You couldn't say that about agencies for a long time in this town. And it is also very, very important in the good news category that the president has begun to articulate his own very strong vision of government. You know, we're so used to listening to how stupid big government is and how stupid bureaucrats are and how big government is interfering with our civil liberties and how we don't really need government and government needs to get off our back. That it is sometimes we miss in the shuffle of all of that what the kinds of statements that President Obama has made, which in a nutshell can be boiled down to We need government to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And every time I think about that, it actually, we were talking about a tickle on the neck. That's what Cass Sunstein said this morning. It actually, it makes me shiver. If only it were a vision that we could actually deliver on. Think about it. A government is for things people cannot do for themselves. That in and of itself, with all these agencies, it describes what their mission is. You really cannot protect yourself from smog on a code red day. You can't do anything about the fact that your Toyota's computerized electronic system that governs acceleration may be going haywire because of radio waves causing your car to run at 120 miles an hour. You can't defend yourself from salmonella in your peanut butter crackers that you give to your kids. And if you're a worker working in high-risk industries like meatpacking and you don't speak English, there's very little you can do to get them to raise the lighting, have a cutoff valve on the equipment, all these basic things that, by the way, series of dry government reports say are not even those basic fundamental things are not happening for people in the workplace. The bad news. Government is hollow. This came up a little bit during the day. The statistics are extremely discouraging. I think the one that can capture it the best for you is the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is responsible for every consumer product that comes into this country or is made here, including, by the way, 80% of the toys that kids play with, which come primarily from China. The budget of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, everything but cars, is $107 million. This is not even the cost of, I don't know what, paper clips at Goldman Sachs. So, and if I, you know, sound a little carried away, it is because these numbers are overwhelming to me. EPA has not had its considerably larger agency and much more robust because of the talents of groups like David's, but it has not had in constant dollars a raise in its budget since 1984, and that was before the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, various reauthorizations of the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, Superfund, Hazardous Waste Law, Safe Drinking Water Act, et cetera. The list goes on and on. OSHA is in, and FDA are in similarly desperate straits. And just another agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is not one of the five we've studied, although I want to include it soon. We're going to be spending $36 billion giving loans to the nuclear industry, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did not get a budget increase this year. So the agencies are hollow, and that's a very serious problem, and one that your generation, I'm afraid, is going to have to seize the problem out of our hands and deal with it. But at least I'm not going to stop talking about it until I'm gumming my oatmeal, which may be sooner than I think. The second piece of bad news, poisoned by a salmonella peanut butter cracker. The second piece of disturbing news is that this administration has continued a trend of centralized control within the White House. You may not realize it, but there actually are 2,000 people employed at the White House. That's probably a conservative estimate. And what's happened is that instead of allowing all these very talented people whose names I just rattled off to lead their agencies forward using what we call in administrative law the neutral competence model, there was some talk here of capture of the agencies, and I think this is a problem we have to think about. I think it's lower in this administration than it has been in a long time. But instead of allowing them to go forward, Cass Sunstein's office, he was here this morning, is extremely powerful because it is exerting control over everything the agencies do. I was talking to a senior member of the administration who told me his press releases were being reviewed by OIRA. And this is not good because it's not the president who's making decisions in these cases. It is a group of very small staff, economists and policy analysts, who don't have the scientific or technical competence to make judgments on all the very complicated issues that deal with climate change, much less food and drug, worker safety, or anything else. And the methodology that they're employing is, as David mentioned, cost-benefit analysis. It's especially disturbing that they have such control, since it's beginning to look as if we will not get the shamefully dysfunctional United States Senate. I won't attribute the dysfunction quite as much to the House of Representatives, which, after all, did manage to run for the wall and get climate change done. Whether you like the bill or not, it was a remarkable achievement by Chairman Waxman. The remarkably dysfunctional United States Senate, it looks as if we cannot expect it to produce legislation until after the midterm elections, at least. And this means not just that climate change will be stalled, but that the food safety bill, which was considered an absolute urgent legislation, won't pass, nor will the administration's supported toxics reform law legislation. If only wishes could be true. So in the final analysis, the big issues, I think, that you need to keep an eye on in the next 2 or 3 years are how much the agencies are given support in real and political terms for carrying out their missions, whether they can come up with strategies that will allow them to take maximum advantage of the laws that they have now. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency has lots of jurisdiction over the coal industry, which is, in some level, at the bottom of our biggest problems on climate change, and could be far more aggressive about the way the coal industry disposes of waste, the way the coal industry mines coal, mountaintop removal, and a series of other regulatory issues that at the moment are getting short shrift and sort of being backburnered. If the agencies are smart in this way and pursue a more elliptical strategy, a more indirect way to get at these problems, and if they are given enough money, and if people insist that they reassume their independence, then I think we can recognize the promise of this administration, which is to have such bright and talented people and to have a president who actually gets it on what government's supposed to do. David is absolutely right that the social costs of carbon are going to be a very, very important issue. When you think about it, how absurd is it that we would quantify what it's worth to lose 40% of the plant and animal species, which is what the IPCC tells us will happen if climate change remains undealt with? That's not a word. So what are all those critters worth to us? How would we put a price tag on it? What does it mean? These are all pressing issues. So I appreciate coming here. I want to thank Mal, who's been delightful and professional. It's a pleasure to be back at American, and I'll sit down.
Thank you, Professor. So, Mel, do we have until 4:15?
Yep.
All right, excellent. What I thought I would do now, since we don't have a lot of time, is we had a series of three questions that we were going to debate, but what I'll do is, if you have a question in the audience, by the way, you can be thinking of it, and at about 10 after, you can line up. But I want to ask each panelist one distinct question, and hopefully I'll ask it whether you can be relatively succinct in your answer. And you've seen, the panelists have seen these questions, the audience has not. And then I'll try to frame them specifically toward each panelist. Kyle, I'll start with you. Your question is going to be, there was a question, we were talking about how the Obama administration had used cost-benefit analysis. I was wondering whether you could talk about the way in which the more diffuse legislative process has perhaps indirectly used cost-benefit analysis in debating cap and trade on the one hand, tax and dividend on the other. I know you didn't talk about that, and that's a big concept, and maybe unfair to you,
versus the Clean Air Act as it is? In other words, could you go through how you perceive Congress has used cost-benefit analysis to look at different legislative proposals on global warming, particularly with tax and dividend as the sort of new piece of information?
Right. Tax and dividend, or cap and dividend, either way, being a kind of a different approach, maybe somewhat exemplified by the Cantwell-Collins bill, which there are many features of that bill, but one aspect of it is it has a cap on emissions, but instead of allocating tradable allowances, it basically requires, creates a finite number of essentially allowances and requires regulated entities to buy all of these allowances, with the revenues then redistributed, at least about 75% of them, to American consumers and taxpayers in the form of monthly dividend checks. And how has cost-benefit worked into this? I think I'm not sure that there's been a cost-benefit absorption of the Cantwell-Collins idea right now in Congress so much as a perception of, oh, my God, there's something we need that's got to be Plan B, and this sounds like Plan B, and it sounds a little bit simpler, and it seems to kind of avoid, you know, bringing us into a complicated debate about how to distribute allowance value. So I'm not sure how much a kind of straightforward cost-benefit analysis has played into that. Interestingly, what I understand economists would tell you is that the kind of the ultimate way to do either cap and trade or cap and dividend or an emissions tax would be to take all the revenues that you generate from distribution of these rights or payment from a tax and use it to reduce a whole set of very inefficient taxes that already exist, like taxes on work and capital, and that if you did that, the economic gains would not exactly wipe out the cost of the cap program, but at least would do a lot to that. They see, a dividend approach as maybe kind of second best to that, and just giving allowances to industry as kind of third best. I guess one thought on just kind of the politics of it, I think one of the things that there is a cost-benefit kind of conception in the Congress is that the distribution of costs from a cap-and-trade program or any type of regulation of carbon is very uneven. So in essentially the Midwestern part of the country, which uses a lot of coal and has a lot of heavy manufacturing, the perception is that any kind of carbon regulation is going to hit that region the most. And so that region has tended to, the senators in that region, Democrats and Republicans alike, and particularly Democrats, have tended to say, whatever you do with the distribution of this value or the construction of this program, it's got to somehow mitigate the greater burden that we're going to get from it, or else it's going to be, you're not going to get our 15, 20 votes that you need to get to 60. So to the extent that there's a cost-benefit analysis that's done politically in Congress, I think it's very much dominated by that calculation.
That's an excellent answer. Thank you very much, Kyle. David, your question is, in terms of how the Obama administration has handled the global warming challenges, what successes have they experienced? What failures? You've already touched upon that. I guess the specific question I wanted to get is, from your experience, specifically with regard to OMB, have you seen EPA's mandate under the Clean Air Act to use, for the most part, best available science and a science-based standard? Have you seen evidence that OMB is injecting a different type of standard? And how do you see that playing out?
Well, no, I don't see that in this in the last year. In the previous 8 years, the White House had a very heavy hand in squelching any kind of look at science and follow the science in any principled way. But I think that could be attributed as much to the Vice President's office as to OMB. Not to say that OMB wouldn't want to have done it, but in the previous administration, but there was a higher power that was asserting itself. I think so far the global warming related rules have made it through OMB without delay and without significant, working over.
Thank you, David. And Rena, you get the bet clean up. The question you were going to get, but I'll tailor it to you as well, no pun intended, is what regulatory developments on the horizon will have the greatest impact on the environmental sector in the coming year? What will be the litigation issues and the what will be the issues? And I guess the more pointed way to ask that is, Rena, in your opinion, is
pointed.
Is do you think that part of the reason that that we still haven't dealt with climate change is that a lot of people just don't believe it's really a crisis? In other words, how has you've done a lot of cost-benefit work, and while the scientists tell us it's a problem, do you see a sense that because it's not here yet and this snowstorm maybe means it's still colder, how do you see, and I know you wanted to talk about other things just about climate change, but the draw to climate change, how do you see climate change working its way through the agencies, and how do you respond to what David just said?
There's a great book that's called Trust Us, We're Experts. And the book is outdated. It was written a few years ago. But in this book, it has a chapter on climate change that talks about how the fossil fuel industries, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Business Roundtable spent millions and millions of dollars. By now, it must be billions. Convincing people that the climate science was divided. And one example is to have a petition on the web that you could sign if you were a scientist, and 20,000 people immediately signed it, including biology teachers at the local grade school.
And Posh Spice.
And Posh Spice. See, David knows.
Famous researcher.
So I think what's happened now is for a while we had a little bit of a consensus, it was about the time of Al Gore's movie, that we were going to put the science behind us and admit that our problem was what to do about it. And if you watch the polls, unfortunately we've done some backsliding on that, and the polls show that people are really pretty confused about how big a problem it is. And that's extremely unfortunate because, of course, they're wrong. There was, and this is, I'll offer this last piece of evidence. There is a poll that was done by Pew Center on People in the Press, which is probably the best polling operation in the country. And about 3 years ago, they asked a group of real scientists, who they sort of teased out, to tell them what they thought was the biggest problems facing the world. And everything was on the table, from terrorism to, you know, nuclear rogue weapons to anything you could think of. And 86% of this group said climate change was by far the most important problem that we face for the foreseeable future. So, sadly, the people are wrong. The scientists, the real scientists are right, and Posh Spice is happy and successful.
We have about 5 minutes. I do have some more questions, but I think it'd be apt time to have questions from the audience, if there are any. Don't be bashful.
Oh, tired.
Come on. They are tired. Well, let me throw one thing that all three of you can answer, and then we'll give you a big round of applause.
Give them 30 seconds.
All right. Yes, sir, David.
Silence. That's right. Embarrass them.
There we go.
There. See?
President Obama announced this morning that he was going to take $8 billion of the federal government money to back a loan to build the first nuclear reactor in 30 years. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that new proposal and how that relates to the environment.
Well,
you're looking at anyone in particular.
Let me take a stab at it. I mean, there is a program or an authorization and a funding provision which was passed by Congress calling for these loan guarantees. And the pressure has been building from the industry and from the Congress for the President to implement this. And so that technically is what's happening today, I believe. But in the President's State of the Union address, he embraced basically a strategy to get climate legislation, which has been put forward by Senator Graham and Senator Kerry, and now Lieberman as well, is it Kerry Graham Lieberman trio is working to put together a bill, and it's quite openly that the Graham proposition is that this is the moment in which we can deal with three things, two of which the Republicans want and one of which the Democrats want, and there's some crossover in all of them. Offshore oil drilling, support for nuclear power plant construction, and a climate cap. And you read the State of the Union message, and it's structured to accept that offer, to say, I'm ready to make that deal with you. If you Graham, and the can bring along some more Republicans, and we can get to 60 around a bill which has a climate component as well as some more conventional and some would say distasteful energy components, he would be willing, they would have a deal. And frankly, well, we haven't seen what's in the offshore oil component, and we know, of course, what's in the announcement today, but we don't know what else might be in legislation in the nuclear area. I've said we wouldn't reject a climate bill because it had nuclear provisions in it, but we also wouldn't accept, you know, there's a limit to what kind of nuclear provisions we'd accept because they came along with a carbon cap. So we have to see what the package is. And, you know, the old expression about sausage and legislation are the two things you never want to see being made.
Thank you.
Any other panelists want to respond, Rena?
Yeah, I would say that yesterday I just finished printing out every GAO report that has been published in the last 7 years on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And there's a lot of them. I was standing at the printer feeling warm despite the cold weather for a long time. And that agency has as serious problems as all the other ones. So this nuclear thing looks like it's here to stay. If we're really concerned about safety, never mind Yucca Mountain, but the actual safety of the way the plants operate, it's time for folks to take a real close look at that agency. And I hope to do that soon myself.
And I can say also, just supplement, the other issue to take into account is just the economic viability of these projects. There's a Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office has to score loan guarantees. In other words, how much do you have to carry on the budget to cover the possibility that the loan will be defaulted on? And, of course, the higher the risk of default, the greater the percentage of the loan value you have to account for in the budget. And my understanding is, I haven't seen this report, but they pegged the default risk at higher than 50% for these projects. The Energy Department said today they don't agree with that, and, you know, one could bore into that more.
Kyle, any words?
Yeah, I mean, just a general thought that I think a lot of us have come a long way in our views towards nuclear power. It's, for myself, it seems to me that if we're going to get to where, you know, we're talking about 80% reduction from 2000 levels by 2050, nuclear power is going to have to play a big part in that, as well as carbon capture and sequestration, as well as wind power, as well as efficiency, as well as electric vehicles. Nuclear power is, my sense is, a pretty tested, and I think is borne up in terms of safety over the last years quite well. But it will take some, like some of these other technology breakthrough areas, will take some amount of capital investment that we have to decide whether it's worth it to prime that pump to get that out there, to be able to deliver that amount of base load electricity at zero carbon or not. But these are the kinds of decisions that we'll have to make as a public over the next few years.
Thank you, Kyle. Rem, you get to ask the question, but it must be a yes-no question.
Or we could control ourselves.
Yes, we'll or that. But you get the last question, Rem. But
it's not yes-no. Is that okay?
All right, go for it.
Do you agree with that yes-no?
Leaving aside the issue of domestic nuclear fuel
extraction, leaving aside the question of that regulatory regime and how you feel about it, what can be done from an international standpoint to improve regulation of the extractive industry elsewhere? There are a lot of externalities to the extraction of uranium and thorium ore, and those are probably felt pretty distinctly in Australia, Canada, and South Africa, among other countries. Climate change has a big international focus, but is anyone talking about treaties to deal with the extractive industry, particularly if we're going to move more toward nuclear power?
Treaties or regulation? That's a great question.
Probably ask you've satisfied the yes-no criterion, because I have to say I don't know. I don't know anything about that. But
Professor Hunter is, aren't you?
Step up to the microphone.
Well, I think there's no treaties in the offing. I can say that pretty confidently. There are, the question of how to deal with the life cycle impacts of mining operations, whether it be uranium or other extractives, there's a lot of different ways of dealing with that internationally. I would say, at least bring it back domestically, that agencies want to look at is what are the standards or policies that are going to put on our financing overseas of foreign direct investment, either through things like the Export Credit Agency, which also could relate to some issues about subsidies for coal, or our role in the multilateral financial.
Or I would think maybe something like, you know, the Equator Principles that make you walk over to whatever the World Bank guidelines are in that area, which may address that.
But
that's actually been
current treaties.
Yeah.
You know, shockingly, the Center for Biological Diversity is suing over some uranium extraction out west, so I know that surprises those. A big, healthy round of applause for our three panelists. Thank you very much.